So what I would like to talk about this evening is a little bit is about precepts and ethics. As some of you know, that the traditional way in which the spiritual path is taught in Theravada Buddhism, and traditionally in Buddhism, is meditation practices are often taught relatively late in the sequence of progression, sequence of practices, and that usually at the first practice a person is taught, if you go still to this day in Southeast Asia, if you go to a meditation monastery, often what you're first taught is you're taught ethics, and ethics meaning just simply wholesome behavior, activity, way of living that's conducive and supportive of a spiritual life. And that includes the ethics of generosity, and that's usually taught first, to being generous, and then the ethics of precepts, of living a perceptual life, a life that doesn't harm anyone. And then after that, a person might be introduced to meditation practice. And here in the West, most people are interested in just learning meditation. It's been advertised as being quite useful for anyone, and so people want to see how it benefits their lives and how it can help in their own inner life or their spiritual life or their stressed out life or whatever. And so they often come cold to a meditation center or a meditation group just to learn meditation practice. And then if you keep coming for a while, then eventually we might talk about ethics and the importance of ethics. So we kind of do it in reverse order here in the West. We start with meditation and eventually get to ethics, whereas in Asia often they start with ethics and eventually they get to meditation. However, if we can advertise we're going to have a 5-week introductory course on ethics instead of a 5-week introductory course on meditation, a lot fewer people would probably come. So because of that, partly because of this, I devote sometimes, occasionally I devote the last Thursday before introductory course to talk about ethics. And that way it can look like actually starts today. So welcome to the first day of the introductory course. Ethics is considered a very important subject. It's actually considered in Buddhist tradition a kind of a joyful subject to talk about. Whereas I think in our Judeo-Christian tradition, where ethics has this heavy-duty judgmental quality to it of sin and sin and damnation and all these things and an angry God who judges, there's a kind of legacy of feeling that as soon as you talk about ethics and precepts, that you're talking about something which is you're going to fail at doing, and something which is going to measure your life according to good and bad, right and wrong. And so often, I think, in the West, this kind of energy kind of sinks when we say, oh, now I'm going to talk about ethics. A lot of the people who got interested in Buddhism, especially in the 60s and 70s, very clearly were rejecting the traditional ethics of their culture because they saw so much hypocrisy in it and so much shallowness in the way it was being done. And so they found in Buddhism a kind of a religious system or practice which seemed to offer some alternative to living a life according to some rules that someone had made up many years ago. And then some people who had stayed in Buddhism for a while found out after a while that Buddhism also had a bunch of rules. But the rules or the precepts or the ethical guidelines, I believe, have a very different flavor to them than the way that some of the kind of Judeo-Christian ethics have come down to us, where they're commandments. And perhaps you can see this difference, and I could be wrong with this, but maybe perhaps you can see in the reaction that we have here in the West towards the subject of ethics, which wasn't very popular until very recently, and there's kind of a lowering of energy. People say, oh no, not precepts. Whereas in Southeast Asia, there's often a kind of joy around precepts. Oh, this is really great. Precepts are really wonderful, and they're happy to hear about them. And perhaps the reason for the joy around the subject is that precepts are not considered to belong to the realm of right and wrong, but rather belong to the realm of that which is supportive for one's own spiritual life, one's own movement toward being more open-hearted, more open-minded, more liberated and free. And so rather than kind of a burden that you have to do this kind of stuff, it's more like, oh, this is really great stuff. This is really a helpful thing to do. It really is a friend. It's a friend to me. Because if I take on and live my life in an ethical way, this then supports me in a way that a friend supports me in order to kind of perpetuate and develop my own spiritual life. So rather than looking at precepts as being good and bad or right and wrong, sinful and... what's the opposite of sinful? Sinful and virtuous. Sinful and pure. Or sinful, whatever. The tendency in Southeast Asia, in Buddhism, is to measure ethics, because it still involves some kind of measure of, you know, what's appropriate behavior and what isn't. But the measure is whether it's wholesome or unwholesome. Kusala and akusala is the term. Sometimes it's translated as skillful and unskillful. Is it skillful? Is it skillful? Is it conducive towards towards my well-being and the well-being of my community of people? Or is it not conducive? Is it actually damage my own well-being, psychic well-being, or the psychic and physical well-being of the people around me? And that's a very different flavor of measure than is this, you know, has this been commanded as being right and wrong? If I break this commandment, am I doomed to damnation eternally? Rather, it's kind of a more pragmatic, perhaps situational kind of ethics, where you look at the situation, the context, and say, if I do this kind of activity, what are the consequences? Are the consequences something that move me in the direction of becoming more free or more compassionate or more loving or other people in that direction? Do they suffer less? Or does it move in the direction of increased suffering? And there's nothing kind of, you know, there's nothing kind of moralistic about that kind of measurement. It's just kind of pragmatic. It makes good sense to look at what's beneficial and to notice what is not beneficial. So that kind of flavor, that kind of spirit lies behind the Buddhist notion of ethics. It's not right and wrong, but rather is it wholesome or unwholesome? Is it skillful? Is it conducive towards well-being or is it not? So it tends to be very situational rather than very strict, the rules. It's also said that the violation or the engagement in unwholesome, unskillful activity, the engagement in activity which is harmful to one's own inner psychic life, spiritual life, or the life of others around you, that arises in people, that is a result within people, when they feel uncontented, when you don't feel content in yourself. And I don't know if this is, always so, but it seems like probably we'll find that most of the times that people violate precepts, most of the time when people kind of cause harm to themselves or cause harm towards others by stealing, by killing, by lying, by sexual misconduct, by doing addictive behavior, probably at the root of that is some form or other of miscontent. The root of ethical or wholesome behavior, according to Buddhist teaching, comes from a sense of contentment, comes from a sense of well-being. And it's said then that a person who's deeply matured in their spiritual life simply is not able or capable of violating the precepts, simply not capable with intention, intentionally, killing, stealing, lying, sexual misconduct, or intoxicating the mind and the body. That's the claim. It's maybe kind of a dogmatic claim, but it's a kind of a beautiful claim, I think, that a person who is fully mature spiritually, it isn't that they're kind of really capable and skilled at following the rules or the precepts. It's simply not in their nature to be able to lie. It's not in their nature to be able to kill. So one way of looking then and understanding Buddhist precepts, and this is what the tradition does itself often, is it takes that as a guideline. If someone is fully mature spiritually, someone who's enlightened or partially enlightened, if you study that person's behavior and you say, oh, this is what an enlightened behavior is like. Let me see if I can live my life in accord with this kind of behavior. And so then the precepts arise. They notice that people who are enlightened don't kill, don't steal, don't lie, don't abuse their sexuality, don't abuse other people's sexuality, and don't abuse intoxicants. So then people think, so then Buddhism kind of looks at that and says, oh, this is interesting. These are maybe guidelines for what is supportive for my own practice or for the well-being of my community. And the operating word here is guidelines. It's not commandments. So the five precepts, which are what lay people usually adhere to or align themselves with, not killing, not stealing, not lying, not harming others through our sexuality, and not harming self or others through intoxicants. These five are things that people take on and try to live that way because they're inspired to live that way and because they have a sense that if I live this way, it's going to support me to become more spiritually mature. But what's very interesting with this is not to take it on as commandments, but rather take it on as guidelines or as suggestions. And when you find yourself about to lie, about to say some mistruth, well, oh, wait a minute, I've decided to try to live my life according to this precept not to lie. And here I'm about to lie. What's going on? And so you take some time to explore and study and find out what's going on within you when you find yourself inspired to lie. That is one of the ways in which the precepts in Buddhism works. It doesn't work, you know, it doesn't work in the sense that you notice you're about to lie and you say, oh shit, here I have sinned again. You know, I mean, here I'm a rotten person again. I've noticed how terrible I am doing this over and over again. And, you know, it's hopeless and I might as well go do it anyway. that's not the spirit. The spirit is rather, oh, here I'm about to lie. And I've noticed that I'm more sensitive to this because I've kind of committed myself to not lying. Why is it that I want to lie now? What's going on here with me? And so it becomes a suggestion, perhaps, to study, investigate the situation, rather than impose a fixed rule on top of yourself. And perhaps after you've carefully studied it and investigated it and looked at it all different angles, you might still decide to lie. And, you know, people, you know, when you talk about right speech in these kind of situations, someone will often say, well, you know, if you were harboring Jews in Nazi Germany and the Nazis came and knocked on your door and said, do you have any Jews in your basement? What do you say? Well, I promise not to lie. So, oh, sure. You know, so people will come with wonderful, you know, tests for those kinds of situations. But I think even in such situations, you might reflect a little bit, say, what am I really doing here? What's important for me? And then you might decide to lie. But it isn't a matter of right or wrong. It's a matter of what is best, what seems best in this situation, what's the most healthy for everyone concerned. So, not killing, not taking life. The literal word that they use, panatipata, is something like, I believe, it's that which walks and breathes. The word, first word, panna, is to breathe, like panya. That which breathes, so, and kind of walks. So animals are not said to breathe, I mean, plants are not said to breathe in traditional Buddhist understanding of how the universe is put together. So, you know, it's not, so you don't violate the precepts when you kill a plant, they say. But that's, you know. So, again, one of the beautiful things I believe about the precepts is how all these precepts really are ways of stating this a way in which a sensitive life would be lived. So I believe that as a person meditates, as a person becomes more mindful and more settled on themselves, more content on themselves, and then more sensitive to the world around them, I think it becomes increasingly difficult to kill something. Because it kind of, you feel, I think, almost it's violating yourself. How many of you would eat, you know, how many of you would eat beef, hamburger, if you had to kill the cow? Especially if you grew up with a cow, you know, you grew up on the farm, it's your best friend, you've kind of known for years. You know, go out and, you know, put a bullet in its temple. How many would you know, you'd feel kind of lousy, I think. You kind of feel, well, wait a minute, maybe you'll do it, but you don't go there with great glee, you know. I'm going to kill the family cow. So I kind of use that example because maybe that kind of speaks to you a little bit more. But I think the greater the sensitivity, both in terms of familiarity, but also in terms of openness in the heart, the more difficult it becomes to kill. So the precept not to kill becomes a precept to look at yourself and really sense and feel the situation. What do you really want to do in the situation? Take the time to explore it and then decide. So most of you don't go around killing cows or other human beings or animals too much. So usually what people ask about in this kind of situation is, what about the ants or the cockroaches or the snails in the garden? And, you know, what should we do, you know? It seems like, well, that's a good question. And what I propose, is, you know, my opinion is that Buddhism doesn't offer you the answer. Doesn't say, you know, absolutely, categorically, you cannot kill the ants in your house. Rather, what the Buddhist precept not to kill implies is stop, feel the situation, be sensitive to the situation, be sensitive to what it means to be an ant or whatever, and your relationship to the ants, be sensitive to what it means to be a person with an open heart, and then see in the investigation of the situation what you decide is the best course of action. And that investigation might include reflecting, what are the other alternatives? Because I know for me, I'm willing to kill some ants if it looks like this, you know, the consequences of letting them have the house is pretty dire, you know. The termites, and they kind of, you know, before you know it, you don't have a house. But I've had ants invade our kitchen. And rather than finding some way to kill them or putting pesticide out, we just went to more trouble to keep the kitchen clean. And that worked fine. We haven't had any ants. Same thing with mice. We just got kissed that we got all these plastic, where we live up in the mountains, is, you know, there's mice. We hear them in the wall sometimes. But we got these plastic tubs, big plastic tubs that we have on our shelves. And all the things that the mice can kind of eat into are inside these plastic tubs. As soon as we got these plastic tubs, we stopped having mice. And so we didn't have to face the question, should we kill or not to kill? So the spirit of this is to investigate the situations, feel and sense the situation, and investigate how best to take care of it. And you might decide in the end to kill, but perhaps with much more respect than it would be if you were doing it casually. I had a friend when I was growing up. We were like 11 or 12. He had this lighter. And for some reason, he liked to go over and just torch ants. You know, it kind of made me cringe. You know, but I didn't, you know, it wasn't like when I was, I don't know, a little kid. I didn't have enough sense to know that that was wrong. I mean, to say anything or to kind of verbalize it just felt like an odd thing to do, to go and torch ants. Why would you want to go out and kill some other animal? For the fun of it. I think that people who do that are very much out of touch with themselves, and probably are out of touch with some, don't have access to some deep sense of contentment, spiritual contentment. However, when I was in the monastery at Tassajara, I was the gardener, and one of the questions that I think every gardener has to face is what to do about the gophers. And I reflected deeply on it for a long time. And then I decided, which was different than some other the gardeners, I decided to kill the gophers, to put out traps to kill them. And I don't feel good about that decision. I don't know if it was right or wrong, or the best, you know, situation, the best response. But my decision came when I realized that the garden, which had a lot of work had gone into building a garden, many years and many people's intention. And the garden was kind of a sanctuary for a lot of people. People go there, hang out, and and kind of nourish people in other ways besides creating, making food for people, that I felt there was a balance was between the life of the gophers and the life of this garden, which was kind of more intangible, but still I felt a kind of form of life. And I decided that after trying many different ways of getting rid of the gophers, I decided that I wanted to preserve the life of the garden, and that required putting traps for the gophers. So that's an example of how, you know, you might do that kind of thinking, you know. Again, I'm not saying I did it right. I'm not saying that I would make the same decision today. But that's what I did, this decision I made some 17 years ago. Yes?
Gil, I had a friend a couple of years ago. He was an older Japanese man born in Canada. And he lived here in Palo Alto in an apartment. And he'd get cockroaches in his kitchen. And one day he said he made an agreement with the cockroaches that they should not come into his kitchen. And I guess he did a little prayer ceremony, things like that. And he reported that they didn't. He never saw them after that time that he made the agreement.
Uh-huh. Well, you hear such stories, and Buddhism, you hear Buddhist, traditionally in Buddhist stories, you hear this kind of same thing. You kind of talk to the animals or thing, and kind of often you send them, you do a loving kindness meditation to them, and you kind of, with tremendous goodwill, you kind of say, you know, I need to have this, you know, I need to live here, and, you know, please take your business elsewhere. So, you know, I don't know anything about that myself. I just know there are such stories, and perhaps it works. It would be nice if it worked. And is it necessary? You know, is it necessary to kill him? Or is it, you know, is it another option to keep the kitchen cleaner? You know, there are other options, you know, I'm not going to say it's right or wrong, but when you kill them next time, notice when you're conscious and when you kind of lose consciousness in the activity. You're probably conscious when you feel the kind of malaise or feel the kind of discomfort that exists when you notice the cockroaches. But then what happens as a result of that? Are there habitual responses? Is there fear? Are you acting out of fear? What are you acting out of? And how conscious are you of the situation? And how does it actually feel for you to actually, you know, stomp on them or whatever you do? How do you feel when you do that? Do you feel, oh, great, or, you know, great glee, or... Explore it and use it. So the point is, again, not right or wrong. The point is, can you use these guidelines or the precepts as a way of understanding ourselves better? And as we understand ourselves better, what are the decisions we make then that are our own, not someone else's guideline? And then what Buddhism says is kind of, you know, maybe a trick, because what it says is that if you become very sensitive, you wouldn't kill anyway. Probably, most likely. So, but you come to it a different way. You don't come to it because it's an external guideline. You come to it because you realize it in your own heart that this is what you want to do. So I don't know. I've known people who've taken their snails from the garden and carefully put them in paper bags and take them down to the city park and you know, put them there. To you?
To my daughter's garden.
So there are things like that can be done. Now there are many. So they're kind of peculiar, many kind of small things to do. But what I find that really beautiful is that there are people in the world who think like that. There are people in the world who are concerned about life and preserving life and not being too caught up in kind of automatically getting the pesticides and killing things. So these, you know, sometimes in the Buddhist circles it gets kind of, you know, really, you have these Buddhist centers, you know, and they're big centers and they have lots of activities and lots of people and everything grinds to a halt. They have community meetings and, you know, endless community meetings. What should we do about these rats, you know, and what should we do with the cockroaches, and should we spray? Oh, we can't spray, and what should we do? And, you know, it seems kind of ridiculous for this, you know, 50, 60, 80, 100 adults to sit down and, you know, discuss among themselves what to do with the cockroaches. And maybe it is in some ways, but I think it's beautiful that there are people who actually will stop and really think and reflect and take this kind of thing seriously. If they're willing to take this seriously, you know, probably they're willing to take much more serious transgressions or more serious acts of harm more seriously also. So not to kill is then one of the great guidelines of the that Buddhism offers in ethical life. And then not to steal. And actually the wording for this is differently. The wording is not to take what is not given. So if something, so it's a little bit more, which it means that if an object hasn't clearly been given to you, said here, you can take this, then you shouldn't take it. You should wait until it's given to you. Now, if you go to a store, it's assumed that the owner of the store is kind of offering it for you to take in exchange for your money. But the idea is not to take what is not given. And it's interesting, the monastics, Buddhist monks and nuns, when they go into a private person's home, one of the kind of monastic rules that they tend to follow is they don't touch anything in the house. And that's for two reasons, both because they don't want to be, they want to very clearly not take anything which is not given. So they don't want to pick up a you know some beautiful vase and look at it. They just kind of leave it there. But also because they don't in any way indicate that they like something in the house, because it might be taken as being a subtle way of saying it would be nice if you gave it to me. And monks and nuns are not supposed to ask for things like that, usually. So, since they don't want to take what is not given freely, they try to keep their hands off whatever they, when they come into someone's home. They just stand there and sit down, they sit down. But they don't pick things up, usually. I don't know if that was a good example, but... So not to take what is not given. I think it's really beautiful to be around people who live that way. If you go on Buddhist retreats or go to a Buddhist center and everybody's living that way according to that precept, there's a kind of respect for everybody's possessions which makes it possible to relax in a way that we can't quite relax if we're out in the world here, and you know, you can't really know, be sure whether it's okay to lock your car or not, or leave it unlocked, or whether you can put something down and expect to find it. I remember losing my wallet at a temple in southern Thailand. And it was just outside the gate, actually, the temple. And the area was known for kind of being an outlaw area, kind of the Wild West of Thailand. And the statistics were that most adult males carried revolvers hidden away. A lot of violence. So I kind of didn't expect to find my wallet again. So I went back to the monastery or the next day or later in the day, and the abbot called me over and said, "Oh, look what we found. Someone brought it into the monastery, and everything was in it." But that happens, you know, everywhere. That happens, and it can happen even in... I lost my wallet again in Irving Street in San Francisco. I went and had a falafel at a store. And... later in the day, I went to pay for something, and lo and behold, my wallet was missing. So I went back to the falafel place, and like, "Oh yeah, this old guy came in after you left, and he found it where you'd been sitting, and here it is. Everything was intact." I'm inspired when those kinds of things happen. So it's kind of living in a society, living among people who don't take what is not given, but rather, you know, respect people's goods. It's really a beautiful thing, and I think it's a source of joy. Not taking what is not given. And then there's the precept of not harming oneself or harming others with our sexuality. And now that's a huge subject. But the guideline is harm, right? What causes harm and what doesn't cause harm? And I think that's a nice guideline. And you can we can reflect and think, you know, does this activity I'm going to do, is it going to cause harm? Is someone going to be hurt because of it? Or... and if there, someone's going to be hurt, do I really want to do it? So reflect on that. And you also might reflect that probably almost everyone here has caused harm through their sexuality. Or as Jack Kornfield likes to ask, he asked the question, how many of you have not made a fool of yourself with your sexuality? And usually no one dares raise their hand. You know, it's a delicate, complicated place. But not to create harm. To be mindful. There's another way of saying this, to be mindful about sexuality. To understand carefully what's going on. And the fourth precept is not to lie. Not to speak false speech is actually the more literal translation. In Chinese, when they translated this in Chinese characters, this precept became not to engage in words that have no foundation, that have no foundation behind them, that aren't supported by anything, empty words. So not to lie. It's said that a person who does... It's been said sometimes that if you don't lie, you're very you probably won't violate the other four precepts. If you keep this one precept not to lie, probably you won't violate the others. Because often the others come with lying. You steal something, say, oh no. You have an affair with someone else's wife. Oh no, it didn't happen. So lying is a great one, and probably the most difficult one, because we have a lot of built-in lying in our language. Maybe it's not lying. How are you? I'm fine. How are you? Well, now that you ask, actually. But maybe that's not lying, because the expectation when you're asked the first time, you know, how are you? No one expects to get the true answer. What they expect is to get an answer. What they expect is to just make contact. They want some connection. It's like saying, hello, here I am. And where are you? You know, you see me. Yes, I see you. Here I am. So it's often, you know, maybe it's the appropriate answer. How are you? Fine. And then if they don't ask further, then you know they didn't really weren't really interested, and it was just their way of saying hi. But not to lie. To think about, to be reflective, to be mindful of speech and how we speak. Why we choose to say what we do. To be mindful of the ways in which we exaggerate, which is a kind of lying. And then the last precept is not to intoxicate the mind and the body. And this last precept is there because, again, not so much that it in itself creates harm, but when a person is intoxicated, it's very easy to create harm as a result. So the consequences of intoxication is a lot of damage. And as we see in our society, there's a tremendous amount of damage in our society from people who are either intoxicated or addicts, either under the influence or because they addicted to their substance and need to get it. One of the beautiful things I think about Buddhist centers is usually they have they're very strict rules about not having intoxicants at the centers. Like San Francisco Zen Center, there's no alcohol there at the Zen Center. They don't. Students at Zen Center, you know, can leave and drink alcohol if they leave. But in the center, there's no alcohol. And what that does, it provides a kind of sanctuary where people who are struggling with substance abuse can go there and find some safety, find a safe place to be, where it's they don't have to struggle so much, they don't have to be tempted. And I think offering ourselves as examples, offering ourselves as people who are not reinforcing the temptations, I think is a gift to the society around us, especially when we reflect on the tremendous amount of addiction and struggles that people have in our society around alcohol and drugs. But the rule is intoxicants, and that's interpreted a different way. Some people will take it very firmly, they shouldn't do any intoxicants. And some people will understand the rule as being not to take intoxicating substance to the point that you become intoxicated. So if you just take a little bit and you remain clear in your mindfulness, then some people say, well, that's fine, but I'm not going to take it over the edge to intoxication. So this is called ethics. Sila is the Buddhist word. And the word sila means one of the meanings of the word is a bed or a foundation. And I like that a lot because really the understanding in Buddhism is that ethics lays the foundation upon which further spiritual work can occur. The more sensitively attuned we are to ethical issues and living in an ethical way, not just in gross ways, but in subtle ways also, not just simply not killing animals, but not killing the spirit of another person, not killing the generosity of someone else. When I came to Zen Center, one of the unusual rules of Zen Center, in formal situations, you were never allowed to say no to when someone offered you something. If you didn't want it, how do you get around that? But you weren't supposed to say no. And the understanding was, when someone offers you something, they're offering it out of their generosity, and to say no is to kill it, is to kind of shut that off, and it's actually more supportive to receive that act of generosity by saying, "Oh yes, thank you." Many of us feel uncomfortable in receiving, but I think being comfortable with receiving allows other people the joy of being generous, and the joy of generosity then becomes a circle of exchange. So one of the things that I learned at Zen Center was I did it more when I was there than I do nowadays. But when someone offers me something, is to at least take a little bit of it, not just say no automatically, but just kind of say, okay, I'll just have a little bit, just so to honor the generosity of the person. So I said this to point out that there are gross and subtle ways of understanding the precepts, and as we understand more and more subtly, I think it actually reinforces and strengthens and develops the other spiritual qualities of peace and contentment and love that is part of the spiritual path. I believe, and this is the belief since I haven't really done it completely, that if a person only stayed mindful of the precepts, of the five precepts, and started to really study, investigate them, understand them in their subtleties, that in itself probably would be a complete spiritual life that will lead to enlightenment. But you have to be really attentive and really carefully aware. For most of us, we don't do it that subtly, but just doing it in kind of obvious, commonsensical ways then lays a foundation in which it's easier then to become settled and quiet in our meditation practice. As I often say, you know, it's very hard to sit and become quiet in meditation if you just robbed a bank. You know, or your variation of that. If you feel remorse or feel regret or feel confusion or feel upset or afraid because of your actions, it's hard to be settled. And if you're not settled, it's hard to see clearly. And the Buddhist path of spirituality is a path that arises out of clear seeing. So ethics is a foundation because it helps us not to muck up the waters, not to make ourselves more confused, to help us so we can see more clearly. Yes?
You know, it seems like you actually in those last sort of couple of statements laid out a real interesting point, and I'm sort of wrestling with it. That sort of pragmatically, I want to see if this is what you're saying, pragmatically the whole system of having these ethical precepts, it is pragmatic. This is, if you follow these, you're going to be in better shape to have a good spiritual life.
Right.
You know, it's our experience, sort of trust it. But then an alternative way of looking at it is to say, if you examined, you know, deeply within yourself in a mindful manner, how all of these precepts are really connected to your life, that is a very powerful avenue toward enlightenment. But those are sort of two different things in a way. You know, one is very pragmatic. Do this, you'll be healthy. Eat right, you'll feel better.
Right,
And the other is eat right and pay very close attention. But they're not necessarily... You can do one without the other. It's not what you're saying.
Yes, you can do... Well, it's interesting. You can't do one... you probably do the same thing, but the motivation behind doing it can be varied. And one motivation is you do it because you think it's a pragmatically useful thing to do. It helps you. And the other reason you do it is because it seems like a wonderful door of exploration to get more intimate and more sensitive to what our life's all about. And it can be also another motivation is to do it for both reasons. Okay. Another reason for doing living an ethical life, if you want reasons, all this, another source from which these ethical precepts are born is from compassion. So the motivation to do it arises from our compassion, not from pragmatics and not from the desire to use them as tools for exploration, but rather we simply don't want to harm others. I think that the violation of the precepts really had a lot to do about harming others. When you kill or you steal or you lie, you tend to create harm. And so as our compassion matures and gets more sensitive, that also then becomes is expressed through the precepts. Does that make sense? So maybe the precepts are like this multifaceted jewel. They often talked in Buddhism as if the precepts are a jewel and multifaceted in all these different ways of seeing them.
Swiss Army knife.
So with all the different tools?
All these different tools that you can use in it.
And the training in Buddhism, of spiritual training, sometimes divided into three categories: ethics, concentration, and insight. And ethics, the precepts, have to do with our behavior, our actions. And if you can kind of, and it's often the easiest place to pay attention because our actions are kind of gross. They're much grosser than our thoughts, for example. So we start with kind of our actions and kind of, you know, it kind of makes sense. It's kind of the outer circle is the grossest circle of activity, our actions. And we try to be mindful of that. And then the inner circle of that is our thoughts. And with thoughts are kind of addressed a little bit through the practice of concentration. Our obsessions, our kind of preoccupations of the mind that keeps us spinning, the monkey mind, they tend to get settled through a concentration practice, through being concentrated, simply sitting still, being with the breath. And as the kind of the murky kind of monkey mind kind of settles down, then it's a lot easier to see clearly, to have the insight. And the insight, insight practice addresses that which is latent within us, that which is not obviously seen. So the precepts, you know, are the gross activities of our life. Getting a settled, calm mind really addresses in kind of the kind of monkey chatter we have, that it's whatever it is. But once the mind is calm and still and really can penetrate carefully what's going on, then it can penetrate into what's called the latent tendencies. What's called latent, they're kind of hidden usually. The hidden tendencies to greed, to craving, to hate, to ill will, to aversion, to confusion. It's said in Buddhism that there's hidden kind of roots, tendencies within us towards ill will, towards desire or greed, which fragment us as people. But unless conditions arise, they might be hidden. You might not know that they're there. That's why just simply going in a wonderfully quiet place, either in meditation or physically, to a wonderful monastery, live in the woods, where you only get really quiet, is not considered to be enough in Buddhist spirituality, because it doesn't really address the latent tendencies. You have to have a practice that goes deeper than quiet to really reach down to the roots of the psyche. But for that, you need to have a mind that's that can see clearly. And in order to have a mind that can see clearly, it helps to live a life that doesn't stir up your mind any more than it already is. And for that, it's good to take the precepts seriously. But that's, you know, my opinion. So, I've talked a lot, I apologize. Should we have some discussion or should we sit? Should we sit? Quiet our minds? Okay.